explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Did you know you have existed for many thousands of years? The thought of reincarnation escapes most people, as it did me until I read this book. Your Never-Ending Life is the first in the Universal Learning Series from Sandy Andrew. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. The treasures of the eternities are yours, and your first step is to read the book. Click the banner for Your Never-Ending Life by Sandy Andrew at X Squared Radio and order the book today. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in this series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. Explorers. This is your host, Brooks Agnew, with X Squared Radio. In the last 48 hours, there has been remarkable development on the sun. Little sunspot 904 has been growing at an alarming rate. These types of sunspots are very unstable and pose a threat for M-class flares and possibly X-class flares. It also has morphed into a dumbbell shape, each side about the size of a planet. Solar scientists are watching closely for changes, but be aware that high-power cosmic flares are possible. The solar wind is still calm at 361 kilometers per second, and there are no coronal holes facing us at the moment. I just thought you might also like to know that on August 2nd, it snowed about 5.2 inches in Johannesburg, South Africa. And that's not the first time, but it is extremely rare. The weather has been doing some very strange things lately. We here at X Squared Radio want you to do three things for us. We have committed to bringing you all our content for free. You can listen for free to the live broadcast, the archives, and even the podcasted archives. All we ask is that you do the following. When you get ready to buy inkjet cartridges or historical replicas or other neat stuff for your space, please shop the affiliates at X Squared Radio. The prices are extremely low, and in most cases you get free shipping. So sign up for our newsletter and send us the call letters of your local AM radio station. If you'll do those things, we'll make sure our sponsors and affiliates pay to bring you this program at their expense. Next week on X Squared Radio, I will be broadcasting live from Trout Lake outside Seattle, Washington, after the Science, Spirit, and World Transformation Conference. I am open to almost anything, and I hope to see my first UFO that weekend. If you're around, maybe you can participate in some measure with my enlightenment. If you want to stay current on our programs, guests, books, CDs, DVDs, and other outstanding stuff for your space, you can make X Squared Radio your favorite place on the web at x2-radio.com. And we're here at the pleasure of BBS Radio Network and broadcasting via satellite out the Global Star Radio Network. Tonight we have two guests for you. The second is Jackie Woods. She is a relationship counselor and the author of her new book, Soulmate or Cellmate. Hopefully we can learn something about how to heal ourselves and maybe even the human race from the conflicts that threaten to consume us all. Our first guest needs almost no introduction. He is a bold and brave leader in the effort to reveal the true nature and purpose of UFOs and the travelers within them. He has inspired us and challenged us and our governments to release the technology that would set this planet free of the energy barons who seem to control the entire population. Now he has moved us, and in particular me, deeply, with his new book, Forbidden Truth and Hidden Knowledge. I am highly complimented that he has agreed to join us tonight and share his thoughts and passions about his work in trying to set in motion the next 500,000 years of humankind. Please welcome with me Dr. Stephen Greer. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you very much. Just a brief note. The title of the book is Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge.
Hidden Truth, Forbidden there. Knowledge. No and in between. Sorry about that.
Yeah, just Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge. And it's really a memoir of my journey since about age 8 or 9 when I had my first sighting of a UFO, and coinciding with the time when my uncle was building the lunar module that put the first man on the moon. And it's been a long journey since then, of course, but it's really the inside story of what I have found leading expeditions all over the world, making contact with these extraterrestrial vehicles, and also the experiences I had that led to my awareness of what the real nexus of communication is between humans and other intelligent life forms. And it's not what a lot of people would think, but it's really the place within us where unbounded awareness, or what people call non-local consciousness, comes together with sub-electromagnetic technologies and communication systems that extraterrestrial civilizations are using. And so it's and one part of it is dealing with sort of the way the world is and who's running it and what we need to do to change it. But the other part of it is really my own personal sharing of these sorts of experiences and sharing what the cosmology is that we need to understand in order to become ourselves interplanetary citizens.
Well, let me quote something from your book. You said, "Humanity now stands at a crossroad. We will either continue to destroy the Earth and its inhabitants through ignorance, warfare, and conflict, or we'll reach a state of spiritual enlightenment and social maturity from which we acknowledge our inherent oneness. If not, then powerful technologies will remain in the hands of people who are submerged in ignorance, superstition, and conflict." I have several quotes like that from your book that I've just circled, and I think I'm going to print them off and put them on my refrigerator.
okay. Well, yeah. Thank you.
The book is so poignant. It more or less describes what you said, but in such depth and such detail and such emotion that it consumes the reader, and I can't thank you enough for producing it.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you for sharing that with your listeners. It's really a telling from the heart for me. Many people have known of the work we've done through the Disclosure Project, and by the way, people can get the book at disclosureproject.org. But the real inner reality of what we're dealing with is that one whole era of human experience is closing, and we are opening another new chapter. And this has been going on for over 100 years, but we're reaching a crescendo now where the real challenge to humanity is the creation of a sustainable civilization where we truly realize our fundamental oneness and something beyond just intellect and the physical realm, but into sort of deep aspects of our own conscious spirit. And I think that the extraterrestrial civilizations that have been aware of the Earth for so long and who are observing our progress or regress or both, as it may be in turns and fits and starts, are very aware of this. And what's interesting is sort of the understanding of how this understanding of consciousness crosses over into some of the cutting edge areas of physics and science and the communication systems. And that's what we're dealing with when we're talking about civilizations that have mastered the ability to go beyond the speed of light, what I call through the crossing point of light, and have been able to get to this point in space-time.
Are we, in some sense, able to do that as well as human beings?
Well, of course, every human that's conscious and awake has the ability to access that aspect of themselves that is the infinite mind that's within all of us. And, you know, the father of quantum mechanics and particle wave theory, Erwin Schrödinger, said the total number of minds in the universe is one. And this is literally true, and it's been actually borne out through very good studies that have been done, that the conscious intelligence within us is a singularity. And while we may identify it with our individualities and our bodies and our intellect, in reality, the faculty of being awake, the simpleness of being awake, is a universal constant. And so every human being is, in fact, a universal being. And what's astonishing is that the totality of the entire cosmos is folded within every intelligent being. And so that you come to realize that we're really universal resonators, and that within the reality of every intelligent being, not just humans, but extraterrestrials as well, is this ability to be aware of that cosmic being, and through that, understand the totality of how the cosmos is folded within. Ironically, the thing that most people, you know, have a hard time kind of accepting is that every point in space and time is perfectly integrated to any other point in space and time through the nature of this infinite cosmic mind that is the nature of awareness. And this is one of the things that I believe every interstellar civilization comes to grips with, and it begins to be the central science of that civilization once they bump up against what I call the crossing point of light, the technologies and the sciences that go beyond light speed, and you begin to cross into what the mystics used to call the etheric energy realms and the astral energy realms. And in fact, that's what we're talking about, is that the ability to go beyond the speed of light requires the ability to understand these finer realities, finer aspects of creation.
I like the way you put it in your book. You said, we live in a cosmic moment where humans are starting to go into space, and where we're beginning to wake up to the fact that we're being visited by extraterrestrial civilizations, and simply realizing the oneness of humanity isn't enough. It's the way you put things in your book. I know you recited it and it was written down, but the thoughts are so powerful. I learned so much more about UFOs and trans-dimensional travelers in the 325 pages of your book than in my entire life. But I was touched at Stephen Greer, the human being, the intergalactic ambassador, more than I could imagine. How did you come to this point where it meant so much to you to reveal your mission and your soul to the world?
Well, you know, this has really been my reality since I was a child, to be honest with you. And I had an experience with a UFO when I was quite young, and it left an extraordinary impression on me. And years later, and that was when I was 8 or 9, when I was 17, I got very sick, and I had a near-death experience. And that experience flew in the face of everything I'd always been taught, because I was raised a very, very devout atheist. And my family, if it didn't attest to, it didn't exist. So I had this experience where I went out into space and went into a state of what the mystics used to call cosmic consciousness, and then unity consciousness and God consciousness. And in that state, I realized that everything is folded within the structure and fabric of conscious mind. And I was actually given some choices about whether to return to Earth or continue in that journey. And I was asked for guidance and was told to come back to the Earth. And it was transformative. And what I began to do after that was to study meditation techniques, and eventually became a meditation teacher. Many people don't realize that before I was a medical doctor, I was a meditation and teacher, and to study those disciplines, and began to have extraordinary experiences in the state of cosmic awareness and unity consciousness and things of this sort. And one night, I decided to hike up to the top of this mountain in North Carolina where I was a college student. I had just turned 18, and I was sitting on this mountain at sunset to meditate, and it was about 5,200 feet up, and quite chilly in the fall of that year, and this was 1973, and I looked over to the west, and here was this beautiful disc-shaped, shining ET craft, identical to what I had seen when I was 8 or 9 years of age. And it sort of appeared, and then it just dematerialized and disappeared. And I thought, oh, well, they're back. And I didn't think too much more about it, and I sat and went to my meditation. And it was a very deep meditation. And at the end of it, it was by the time I finished, it had gotten dark, and you could see the entire Milky Way galaxy above my head. And I stood up and looked up at the sky, and a thought that wasn't my own said, behold, what a beautiful universe God has made. And with that, I went right back into that state of unity consciousness where the awareness within me was infinite, and I could see that everything, every tree, the entire earth, was consciousness itself phasing and resonating as that thing. And then I became aware that there was a creature to my right, and it was an extraterrestrial biological life form. And it came over and it touched me on my right shoulder, and I was wearing a ski jack, and I'll never forget the feeling of the finger of this ET touching my right shoulder and seeing my ski jacket and then. And with that, I went into a state of consciousness that's very hard to describe, but found myself floated onto this ET craft that was just below the crest of this high mountain, and had a very prolonged experience. Now, a lot of people say, gee, what did you talk about? Well, what we were really doing is that we were sitting in this state of, some would call it samadhi or nirvana or enlightened meditation together. And we kind of co-created this protocol for communicating where now I, of course, I'm going to be up on Mount Shasta at the end of this month for a week with people who want to join us, and we'll be in Palm Springs and Joshua Tree Wilderness in November, and out here near Charlottesville, Virginia, the beginning of October. And what we do is that we go into the state of consciousness, and it's really the Rosetta Stone of extraterrestrial communication, because when you go into this universal state of awareness, you can do what some people call remote viewing, but it's really the ability to know and see these vehicles and these people at remote distances and then vector them in. And so what we did when I had this experience in 1973 up on this mountain was to kind of co-create what's now been called the CE5 initiative, or the Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind initiative, which was the original CSETI project, the Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence, which is the parent organization for the Disclosure Project. And it involved these specific protocols. It's actually a very specific type of consciousness-assisted remote is sensing and vectoring of these craft with their communication systems and connecting to them and then showing them your location on the Earth. And we began to do this, and of course, after I had this experience, I found myself back on this gravel road near the top of this mountain. And I thought it had been maybe half an hour. It turned out it had been 2 or 3 hours or more that it passed. And it was just an amazing experience. And I actually had sort of an anti-gravity field around me where I could cover 20, 30 feet in each step when I was going down this mountain. I was almost like the moonwalker that you see these videos of. And sort of gravitational effect around my body was greatly altered. And it's an extraordinary story. I often don't, you know, for years I didn't share this information because I said people go, oh, come on, it's possible. But I've decided that it's really time for people to know, and it's time for people to know what the real truth is about this, and also why an emergency physician would leave his career to try to get this information out to the public, because it's not only about the technologies that are being kept secret, and because they're being kept secret, we're still using oil and gas and coal and what have you. But it's also the consciousness of how we're living and how we need to understand that the basic oneness of intelligent life in the cosmos, and that we're really all one people shining through many different types of bodies. And once you come to realize that, there's really no fear of this. And so that's what I experienced very early on as a young boy and as an 18-year-old young man. And so I decided that it was time for me to begin to share this information with people in some depth. And that's why I say this is really a personal memoir. And in many respects, it was difficult for me to put out there because for most people it seems a little far out. But it's the truth. And so I decided it was time for me to share that with people.
I'm glad that you did. I told you before we came on the air that I recently relocated from North Carolina to Western Kentucky, and sort of maybe for good old time's sake, I drove up to Grandfather Mountain and I went out on the suspension bridge. I know you know where that is. And I was just looking out over the states that you can see from that bridge, and I was thinking about things, and I don't know why, but for some reason Disclosure Project came to mind, and I knew that soon I had to have you back on the program. And in reading your book, it seems like the book is about two things. First, about what we have been talking about this higher awareness, this almost an avatar of humanity. But also, it became evident that there's a script being written for UFOs and alien visitations. The eschatological camp, we'll call them, who apparently believe that Earth and its inhabitants must be involved in some global war and conflagration so Christ can return, has painted a very wrong and corrupt picture of who these visitors are.
Correct. And I think that 90% or more of everything that's out in the public domain on the subject is some type of filtered disinformation, which has one central purpose, and that is to frighten people and through that fear control them. And what I have found, and of course you have to understand, CSETI since 1990 for 16 years has had teams of people that have gone all over the world and have made contact with these ET craft and with these beings, many times videotaped, photographed, mass witnessed. And I'm not talking once or twice, I'm talking hundreds of times. We have never been threatened or harmed. What I have found, however, is that there is a counterintelligence program that is very rogue and shadowy, that has been hoaxing things that look like UFO events, and they're not. They're completely man-made. And a lot of folks don't realize that since the 50s, we have had devices that look like UFOs that are man-made, and they have been used in counterintelligence and psychological warfare programs to make people think that they had been accosted by some alien or that there was some threat from outer space. And I'm talking about not just people in the general public, but some of our military and political leaders have also had these sort of things happen to them. And it's been done so that they can be manipulated into supporting Star Wars, weapons in space, and the eventual eschatological solution to the human problem. I hate to say that, but this sort of weird, fanatical, hyper-religious view of we have to have this big Armageddon event take place so that Christ will return, or the Imam will return, or the Messiah will return, whoever will return. And it's all a complete concerns is that people need to know that we're already over 100 years into a totally new time, and that the people who are driving the Earth in this direction are looking in the rearview mirrors and are trying to say that they're dealing with the future. And so we need to say, wait a minute, here's the good future that awaits humanity, and we can choose this. We can choose to go down this path of a global geophysical and geopolitical destruction, or we can choose to live together in peace and to go into space peacefully and to use the wondrous new sciences and technologies that have been on the Earth, by the way, for decades, and which have been secreted away into places like Lockheed Skunk Works and Northrop and SAIC, Science Applications International Corporations, and other corporations, where we, if these were used, would enable humanity to completely leave poverty behind and live in abundance and in peace and justice. You know, with the way the world is running today, using oil and gas and coal, there's no way that 6 billion people can live like Americans. And it's estimated that the Chinese in the next 10 years will put enough coal-fired electric power plants online that it would be the equivalent of 3 billion Ford Explorers being driven at the same time.
Oh my goodness.
One of the problems is that the zero-sum game of fossil fuels, it was understandable in the mid and late 1800s, maybe the early 20th century, but you know, by the 1950s, it was well known we didn't need these technologies, and we had very advanced physics that had worked out the extraction of enormous amounts of energy from the space around us. And I'm not talking outer space, I'm the space room you're sitting in.
Mm-hmm.
And that would allow for free energy, abundant energy, clean energy, and the lifting of the tide of all of humanity. Now the question is, you know, people say, well, gee, then why don't we have it? Well, it's because somebody owns that $200 trillion asset base called coal, oil, gas, fossil fuels. And more importantly, the geopolitical game that's being played of how the world runs and who runs it is about that kind of big monkey geopolitical power plays, rather than what's right for humanity and what's the destiny of humanity and what's the good future awaiting humanity. And so when I came to realize that this whole issue was not only about the fact that we're being visited by advanced civilizations from elsewhere, but that there is a rogue, transnational, and corrupt entity numbering about 200 or 300 people in the policy group, many of whom I've met with, by the way, who are hell-bent on driving the world over Niagara Falls without a barrel. And I think that not all of those folks, by the way, believe that. We have found that since the 90s, when I began briefing the Clinton administration, and, of course, I met with CIA Director Woolsey, who was being interviewed today, by the way, on CNN, talking about the energy crisis. We found that, you know, there were a lot of people who were open to disclosing this information. And about a third of this covert group supported that idea. Now, I'm told, over half of them do. But there's still a very retrograde and quite frankly, ruthless group that want to keep this secret. And, unfortunately, they're trying to hold on to the status quo for so long that the worst possible events will have to happen unless we figure out a way to get the truth out. And so this book, Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge, is my attempt to share the full picture, the big picture of what the truth is and what I think we as humans have to do to get it out to the public.
Hmm. Well, you say in your book that we cannot stand idly by and let rogue kleptocrats run roughshod over the entire Earth and cannibalize the Earth, killing millions of people. What can we do as citizens of the Earth to usher in the next 500,000 years of humankind in peace and balance with the Earth and its galaxy?
Well, I think we can do several things. First of all, what CSETI is doing, and people can learn about this at CSETI.org,
mm-hmm.
We are training people to become ambassadors to these other civilizations. And people say, you're doing what? And I said, look, way back in 1990 when I started this project, it was based on these experiences I had as a young man. But I came to realize that there was no agency at the State Department or the UN dealing with this. And the only face being shown to these visitors was, for the most part, a militaristic one and a violent one, where we were using advanced electromagnetic pulse weapons and other technologies to target them and hit them and knock them down. You know, these ET craft that we've acquired haven't traveled through interstellar space and then just crashed on the Earth because they don't know how to navigate. They have been deliberately hit with advanced electromagnetic weapon systems. So the question becomes, shouldn't we humans, even if it's citizens of diplomacy, if you want to look at it that way, go out and make peaceful contact with all of these extraterrestrials? Civilizations. And by the way, I don't believe any of them are hostile, and I'm quite sure none of them are working with some secret group on Earth trying to enslave us or what have you. There's a lot of disinformation out there that's designed to scare people, and I believe it's completely false. What we have found from our own direct experience with these craft and the people on board them, as well as my investigation into these secret governmental and paragovernmental programs, is that they're really waiting for us to respond to them in a way that's halfway sensible and enlightened. And I think that's something everyone can do. And as I mentioned, we're doing several of these expeditions, the week-long expeditions at Mount Shasta and in the Palm Springs area and in Virginia over the next few months. And we invite people to join us if they're so inclined. But I think the other thing people can do is to share the truth with other people. It takes courage to do it. But I tell folks, if they go to disclosureproject.org, they will find the testimony of dozens of military and intelligence people, highly credible, with corroborating documents and their testimony. There's an entire 600-page book of their testimony and government documents that we put together so that anyone who can read English will understand that this is true, that we are being visited, and that there are extremely advanced technologies being secreted away from the public. Illegally, I might add, without the permission of most of the U.S. presidents and certainly the knowledge of Congress. So what you find is that this has got to be shared from one person to another, because the big media, when they start to cover this story, usually get a phone call and are told to stand down and to kill it or spin it or water it down or to put some kind of ridiculous spin on it. So we, the people, have the responsibility of educating our fellow humans. And then the other thing we can do is that I'm heading up a group of scientists to develop on our own, outside of the Lockheed and Northrop and covert paragovernmental programs, these technologies, these so-called zero point and anti-gravity technologies. And we need support from people who want to see that happen and see the environment fixed and a new type of energy brought forward. We've been doing this with very modest funds. We need some serious funding to come forward. We need people with serious technical ability to come forward and help us. And my view of it is that we should not sit around and wait for the folks who are sitting on this stuff to come out with it. I think by the time they would, it'll be too late. And I remember, you know, there are three people on my team who were at a meeting with Ben Rich, who is the head of Lockheed Skunk Works, and he said three very interesting things that I recount in this new book, Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge. He said, first of all, there are no private conversations anywhere on Earth. He just flat out said it. But secondly, anything you can imagine doing, we have already done at Lockheed Skunk Works, I mean, beyond Star Trek type stuff. Thirdly, he said, we already have the means to travel among the stars faster than the speed of light, but those scientists are locked in a black box at Lockheed Skunk Works, and it would take an act of God to ever get them out to benefit humanity. Well, it turned out when he said this, he didn't live that much longer. He had cancer. And I have found that a lot of people in very high positions that I work with, former CIA directors, very senior people who have been at the Pentagon, who've known of these things, corporate people, really want to see this happen. And yet, there doesn't seem to be the political will to do it. And most of the folks who step forward don't know quite how to organize themselves. So what we've done with the Disclosure Project is to put all those witnesses together, and we're still calling for people who have this sort of inside information to come forward and be identified. And I have to point out that almost all these people that we have put forward at disclosureproject.org are named, and we have their DD-214s, if they were in the military, their discharge forms. We have corroborating witnesses and documents. And what we've tried to do is put together a solid case for this. But I think we also have to go beyond just disclosing information and say, look, we really need to do a peaceful Manhattan-style project for energy. And I don't mean just squeezing 10% more efficiency out of the internal combustion engine or burning ethanol and other such silly things. We really need to have these fundamentally new technologies, which, by the way, aren't that new. They've been experimented with since the early 1900s. They've been perfected since at least the mid-1900s. And 50 years later, here we are cannibalizing this beautiful planet and enslaving 80% of the world's population in poverty completely unnecessarily. So I think that we have to come together and say, look, how do we fix this problem? I have identified some wonderful scientists that are working with us now, but we need institutional support, we need financial and funding support, and technical support to get some of these technologies up to a level where they would be able to replace the internal combustion engine or to run people's homes and businesses free of using the fossil fuel system.
And there are contacts at CSETI and Disclosure Project to make those kinds of donations?
Yes, absolutely. Yep. And we're a nonprofit, so 501c3. We're also looking for major institutional support for that. So, I mean, everyone can look at this evidence and conclude for themselves, I believe, that yes, we're not alone. We've been visited. These things have been quote-unquote reverse engineered. And in addition, regardless of reverse engineering an extraterrestrial system, humans, way back in the 20s, we have documentation where humans, quite on their own, had discovered these laws of the universe, because the laws of the universe are universal, where they achieved free energy from the fabric of space, anti-gravity effects. Of course, people know about the Biefeld-Brown effect. T. Townsend Brown was working on this in the 20s, 30s, and 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a document from 1951 from the Office of Naval Research summarizing the work of T. Townsend Brown and these other brilliant people who worked on these sort of electromagnetic anti-gravity systems. So, you know, the laws of the universe really are universal. And there's no reason why we should be sitting here continuing, even though we have integrated circuits and computers and fiber optics, we're still burning coal for 57% of our electricity. It's so ridiculous, just like we were in the 1800s, and this is 2006. So what we're saying is that let's make this next step forward. And yes, there will be some people who won't like that, but so what? I mean, you know, I think that we have to look at what the needs of this beautiful planet are and the 6 billion children, humans who live on Mother Earth. What are we going to do to leave the Earth to our children and our children's children in a way that can be sustainable and live in peace? It certainly isn't using what we're using today. And I'm reminded of this Chinese proverb that says, you know, unless we change direction, we're likely to end up where we're going.
Exactly right. Well, let me ask you this question. Is there an organized and funded effort to stage an alien invasion of Earth?
Yes, we have. I have multiple independent corroborating intelligence and military people who have worked at various times on that project, where they have planned to hoax a false attack on Earth. In other words, if you understand the Gulf of Tonkin incident that happened in the Vietnam era, where we basically hoaxed an attack and exaggerated the attack on our ships in the Gulf of Tonkin so that we could manipulate the public and the Congress into expanding the Vietnam War. Something like that has been planned and has been fully operational since the mid to late 60s. I have a man who sat on a committee in the 70s where he said that they had these things called alien reproduction vehicles. They look like UFOs, but they're made by Lockheed and Northrop, and that they had the ability to use these sorts of devices to attack the Earth, make it look like E.T. did it, so that the world will be stampeded into this sort of Independence Day scenario. You know, remember the movie Independence Day where, you know, Will Smith is there going, let's kick alien butt, and, you know, and let's unite the whole world around, you know, and that kind of nonsense, which is a very predictable sort of manipulation, is something which 90% of the UFO subculture, by the way, has swallowed hook, line, and sinker. Because if you go to a UFO conference or deal with people who deal with the subject, there's, you know, everything from vivisection to mutilations to kidnappings and rape and all this stuff that's proffered is the actions of extraterrestrials. What they don't know is that it's the actions of this covert human group faking or hoaxing these sort of pseudo-ET events for the psychological worth or value they have. And I know people who've been in these projects all the way back to the 60s and 70s, and they say, oh, yeah, we've been doing this for a long time. And
now, very why are they doing it?
Fear sells. People like a good horror movie. But there's also an aspect of human nature, the sort of fight-or-flight response and the tribalistic mind of humans, where if there's something that they don't control and understand, it's easy to manipulate people into the assumption that it's a threat or that it's, quote, bad. And this is the foundation of racism and ethnic conflict and religious conflict. And really what these folks would like to do is unite humanity, but unite it against extraterrestrials so that you can expand this entire covert military-industrial corporate plan from a $1 trillion a year thing that's going on now on Earth with us fighting each other to a multi-trillion-dollar-a-year project where the entirety of humanity would be opposed to and trying to engage in conflict with off-world or extraterrestrial sources. And my concern is that without people knowing what the truth is and without these sort of rogue disinformation plans being exposed, it's so easy to manipulate people into irrational fear. And fear is something that controls the masses very well, as we've seen over the last few years since 9/11. So I think that we have to wake up to this, and we have to say, look, it's time for us to say enough and pull together our wise elders, like the former Minister of Defense up in Canada that I met with recently, the Honorable Paul Hellyer, and he and I spent a whole day together discussing this. And what I found is that there were many people of substance in our society who are interested in this and who would make excellent ambassadors, if you will, to these other civilizations. Why should we abdicate that, I think, sacred task to people who are only looking at the universe through the world, the lenses of conflict and the lens of us versus them? I think we need a different kind of consciousness dealing with this issue.
Who's in charge of these efforts to implement this ultimate police state?
Well, the question of command and control on this is very shadowy. People make a mistake when they say the government is hiding this. I can assure you that 99.9% of the government, I'm sitting here in Washington, D.C. right now, a few blocks from the White House, couldn't find their behind in a well-lighted room when it comes to anything dealing with this stuff. And when I have been at the Pentagon, for example, briefing admirals and generals on this issue, and I've done it many times, what I have found is that most of them are in the dark more than you are. You know more than the average admiral or general at the Pentagon or even CIA director has known about this.
So
it's extremely compartmentalized. There's a sort of permanent bureaucracy that's dealt with it. There have been some senior Pentagon people who knew, but others who don't. It has nothing to do with your rank, and this is what's important to get your mind around. A lot of people think, well, if you're the President of the United States, you're the CIA director, or you're the head of the intelligence for the Joint Staff, you're going to know about this. Well, the answer is no to that. Some might, and if they do, it's because they came up through the ranks, they were giving little bits of information, a little bit of a time, and then they were monitored to see if they would go along with the agenda of secrecy. And if they did, they were given more. If they didn't, they were cut loose or assassinated. So what I have found is that the group dealing with this is mostly corporate and financial. It's transnational. It has tentacles inside various powerful institutions like the Pentagon and the CIA. But for the most part, it is something that operates as its own entity, as sort of a paragovernmental entity. And this has happened at least since the 50s. I believe it was during the Eisenhower era that this really went out of control. And we have witnesses from that era who have pretty much confirmed that assessment, that it was on Eisenhower's watch that he was betrayed and stabbed in the back, and the corporate and financial and international interest on this basically hijacked the management and the details of it away from the normal chain of command of the people we elect. You know, this former Minister of Defense in Canada had a very interesting comment when he and I did a press conference in May up in Toronto. He said, you know, he thinks that there is the government that we elect, and then there's the permanent government. And there's a permanent government, and it has very little to do with the government we elect, except in a few cases. And basically, it's that permanent government that's really running the whole show. And there's this sort of like pseudo-democracy we think we live in, but in reality, this other group has corrupted the media, has corrupted the corporate and financial system, and major segments, powerful segments within the military and intelligence community. So what you have is something which is quite out of control and illegal. And I have to point out to people the reason that we have come forward with these identified people at disclosureproject.org, where people can see their testimony, is because we made the assessment back in the 90s after briefing Clinton's group, after I met with the CIA director. I personally briefed the head of intelligence for the Joint Staff. I personally briefed the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency. And these were all people who should have been in the chain of command and knew. And they were all people being denied access to and lied to, up to and including the U.S. president. And I did similar briefings overseas at the UN and with the Senate Intelligence Committee members and other members of the Senate and House. So what I concluded from all that, and it's all recounted in this book that you refer to, Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge, is that these folks being lied to and being denied control of the subject proves that the group is rogue, illegal, and unconstitutional. And therefore, what our group did was to declare all those operations illegal, and therefore they couldn't cite the rule of law or the National Security Act of 1947 or any other law to maintain the secrecy. And that's when I began to tell people, if you know about this stuff, step forward. If you have government documents, bring them. If you have data, bring it. And I'm still saying that to folks, because they cannot say that someone is breaking their security oath and breaking the law when the group that's imposing the secrecy is itself illegal and rogue and unconstitutional. So I think that's a really important point for people to understand, is that we're on the side of the law here and also on the side of the angels, and that it's very important for people to empower themselves to come forward with the truth.
Well, I know when presidents are afraid to use the pulpit and their voice to say these things for fear of their own life, it's got to be pretty powerful. Listen, to make one round in a single hour, I'd like to maybe talk about another item. In your book, you make the most sensible and definitive statement I've ever heard about reincarnation in your travels and communications with beings from, well, all around the universe. What is the truth about these inclinations toward reincarnation?
Well, you're asking about reincarnation?
Yeah.
Well, the truth about that is so much more complex than what's written about, and that'd take an hour to go into, but I'll give you a hint. Go back to the beginning of this discussion and understand that the conscious mind within every single being and within everything that exists is the same. And, you know, I've met a lot of people who swear they had been Cleopatra. What they don't understand is that in reality, every single person has been and will be every single other person. But it's the understanding of the non-local and, if you will, immortal and eternal and infinite aspects of ourselves that is this unbounded conscious singularity. And when you come to realize that, then you come to understand that there is really no death. There's no beginning and there's no end. And the concept of reincarnation is an attempt for people to understand that they can be and have experienced the lives of others, but it isn't the linear understanding. In other words, the understanding that's out there, let's just say it's not post-quantum. And so it's a complex issue, but it's really very simple. And the simple answer is this: the awake mind within each one of us is the infinite single mind that there is. And in that sense, all of us are each other and have been every other being. And on the one hand, on the other hand, there's distinction and individuality. But that individuality can be transcended into this understanding and experience of this unitive whole. And when that is experienced, you come to understand that we are all one being.
So you actually can glean experience from some times and places you've never been just by this oneness.
Oh, absolutely. And remember that the even any point in space, like if you go to some place, there are actually technologies that were developed by at the White Oaks Naval Facility when it was still open, where they could extract from what's called the white noise of that space, sort of like the Akashic Record, everything that was ever said or done in that point in space, a room, someplace outdoors. And so in reality, even the three-dimensional universe has connections to this, if you will call it, that some would say a trans-dimensional, but a more correct sense is this sort of expanded and non-local quantum, post-quantum reality that's awake and conscious, so that everything is encoded there. So everything is permanently present at every point in space and time. And the barriers that we see that are in the linear three-dimensional world exist at that level. It doesn't say they don't exist, but added to that is this non-local and unitive state that are increasing degrees of consciousness and increasing degrees of non-locality. And it's not just a matter of whether it's linear or non-local. There are degrees of non-locality. So the whole picture I'm trying to paint here is a beautiful integrated cosmos that we can understand if we understand the nature of the conscious mind within ourselves.
You know, if it's possible, I almost got a sound out of your book. You describe a journey that you had where you were exposed to trillions of voices singing, "We are one in spirit." Now, I know they're just written words, but you can almost hear that melody. I was wondering if you have any efforts with musicians or artists to try to recreate that sound for us to hear.
Well, I wish I could, and you're referring to an account that I have in the book where I had an experience, and it was exactly 7 days before my close friend Sherry Adamack, who was the closest person to work with me, and she, and back before we had the level of protection we have now, there were several of us who were killed or attempted to be killed by these rogue elements, and unfortunately Sherry did pass away. But a week before she passed away, I had this experience where I saw the entirety of the cosmos as this sort of like primordial cosmic egg, gorgeous, and it was sort of magenta colored and more peach into the center of it, and it was conscious, and it was as if it was the outer garment of the Godhead, of the divine being, and there was infinite consciousness just permeating everything. And out of this, I heard, I saw, first of all, Sherry Adamack going into that beautiful state of God awareness. But as I did, I could hear these trillions of voices singing this refrain. And I wish I could reproduce it. I'm not musically inclined, but it's encoded in my soul, saying, "We are all one in spirit." And it was just transcendent and beautiful. And interestingly, exactly 7 days to the minute from when I had that experience, Sherry Adamack passed away, and I was by her side there in Denver when she did. And people didn't know why I appeared the way I did the night before. And I said, well, I knew when she would pass away because I was shown this experience, and I knew it was the time of her passing. And one of the things I say to people is that being a physician and being an emergency doctor, and I've been around a lot of people who passed away, that we should always remember that even when the body dissolves, the inner self continues, and that we should have people around us at all times who are connected in prayer and in meditation, connecting to this beautiful and infinite world as we make our transition to that state.
I appreciate you sharing that experience with us, not just in print, but also tonight for our listeners. I know you have a dinner engagement coming up in a few moments, and I did ask you before we went on if you could stay longer, and I appreciate that you can't, but I appreciate the hour that you've given us, and it's been my pleasure. I'm just highly complimented by your being here.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate your help and support and networking for us.
Well, absolutely, and when I'm up at James's place there at Trout Lake, I'm sure we'll talk about you, and it'll all be good.
Yeah, well, have fun up there. Yeah, we're going to be on Mount Shasta September 2nd through the 9th, which isn't far from there. We go up every year, and, you know, we've had some amazing encounters with these ET craft and sightings when we've been up on Mount Shasta. So we love it there. It's a really beautiful and sacred area.
Well, I may join you out at Joshua Tree National Park when you're there.
Wonderful.
I used to go dirt bike riding out there when I was a kid. It's kind of interesting. You're about a month younger than I am, and a lot of the places that you've been, I've been. I've stood in the same place you have, but at different times, and I kind of feel like a kindred spirit, although well in the background. I appreciate your being here tonight. Are there any final things that you would like to tell us, things that are coming up that you want us to be aware of, that you want us to be involved in?
Well, I think people, like I said, if people can assist us with these technology programs, we need that help. And people who are interested in becoming peaceful ambassadors to these civilizations, they should try to come to one of these retreats, or they can learn about it. We have a training kit. The idea is that the more people who go into that state and intent, the more it moves human consciousness in the direction of peace and in the direction of what I call the good future, which awaits humanity. And I tell people not to worry about all the chaos that may happen or is happening, because what's really unfolding is a 500,000-year cycle of unbroken peace and progress and enlightenment on Earth. And it's the most wonderful time in the history of this planet since it's existed, in the billions of years this planet has existed. And so we should be happy at that and work to create that and not be too concerned about the crumbling old world as it falls apart. It's bound to happen. What we should focus on is creating this new and beautiful civilization.
Even if there are cataclysmic events coming about, they'll probably only be geophysical or cosmological, but the race of man will continue, and we will grow into the galactic citizens we should be.
That's right. That's right.
I feel the same way. Thank you for writing the book. Thanks for being on the program tonight. I will let you go.
Well, thank you.
And peace to you, my friend.
All right. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. All right, we will take about a 6.5-minute break, after which we will we'll bring on Jackie Woods with her book, and we'll be back after these messages. Jackie Woods. We'll be back right after these commercials. Did you know you have existed for many thousands of years? The thought of reincarnation escapes most people, as it did me until I read this book. Your Never-Ending Life is the first in the Universal Learning Series from Sandy Andrew. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. The treasures of the eternities are yours. And your first step is to read the book. Click the banner for Your Never-Ending Life by Sandy Andrews at X Squared Radio and order the book today. You know we have revealed to you the ancient predictions that natural disasters are going to increase in power and frequency in these times. We might not always have the National Weather Service or the Emergency Broadcasting Service. So you might want to get your hands on some of the best weather reporting instruments around. Visit Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio and pick up something that might be useful. They also have the neatest gifts for your favorite people who like things for the outdoors or for their meditation garden. Check out Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio. You know, dust is a place where the past meets the future. If you have done your genealogy and found that you have roots in the Irish or Scottish clans, then don't you think it would be a great idea to have a replica of your family crest? You can get a coat of arms, a ring, or even a family tartan that may help you or your grandchildren remember your ancestors. This is the time when the hearts of the children are turned to the hearts of the fathers. We only carry the best. So if you're ready to experience the glory of your past, you're ready to visit Scottish Heirlooms at X Squared Radio. People are always looking for something inexpensive and unique. Give people they love. Well, now there is a way to give a gift that not only says how long you will love them, but it also allows you to help keep the planet green and growing. Tree Givers at X Squared Radio is the company that will plant a tree on public land somewhere in the 50 states and provide your special person with a beautiful certificate of that place. This has become one of the most popular gift sites in the world, and because of their love for the earth, they are changing the world. So visit Tree Givers at X Squared Radio and see if you can find a gift for your special person. There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the 6-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. This is where the past meets the future. According to my AccuWindow forecast, it's about 90 degrees outside in western Kentucky. Our next guest is Jackie Woods. She holds one of the highest callings in life as teacher of how to discover oneself. She recognizes that we are beings of energy and as such are challenged to harmonize with one another. As we can tell from the 24-hour-a-day news industry, we are not doing a very good job at it. I felt it was time to introduce a healing element in our content here at X Squared Radio, so we have invited her to talk about her new book, Soulmate or Cellmate. So please welcome with me Jackie Woods. How are you tonight?
Thank you.
You might have to speak up just a little bit so our listeners
can
hear you.
Can you hear me now?
There we go.
Yes, okay.
Well, I don't think there's one human who doesn't wonder if perfection exists in human relationships. We dream about it. We hope for it. We even despair over it. But are we willing to work for it, do you think?
Some people are, thankfully. But most people still like to hold on to that fantasy that sometime in life they will find the clone that will not only match all of their patterns, but that will also meet all of their needs. And that's what is the beginning of a cellmate relationship.
Oh, yes, I understand that. You might have to speak a little bit into your phone, or if you have another telephone that you can go to, that would help. I think your connection's a little bit crackly, but if you don't have another, we can make it.
Yes, it is. I'm speaking directly into the phone.
Is
this better?
Yeah, it's better.
Okay.
Well, is there a starting place for people to find our perfect soulmate?
The starting place, Brooks, is just the individual. You know, as long as we really need a relationship, we're not ready to begin.
Well, it's kind of like going to the loan going to the bank asking for a loan. If you need the money, the bank's not willing to loan it to you. But if you don't need the money, they've got a loan almost before you leave the building. How do we work around that?
But the truth of the matter is, you have to know who you are to know what you have to bring to a relationship instead of what you're going to go and need from one. So you have to know what you're going to bring. And hopefully the other person knows what they're going to bring. And when you have the combination of the two, then you can begin to define what I call the third entity relationship.
Well, sounds like we have two challenges. I know some kids who really know who they are. And I also know some adults who don't have a clue. So how do we start that?
I think the beginning point is to realize that we're not our hobbies. We're not how much information we have stored in our computer minds. We're not our feelings. We're not any of those parts. We are an essence that expresses, that I call heart energy, qualities of character that express through those parts of us, that express through our feelings and through our actions and through our thinking. And when we start at the top, so to speak, and that comes down through us, then we become whole. And when we become whole, we have a whole person to offer to someone.
Well, I kind of feel like, at least my personal feeling is, that maybe we don't really get whole until we're joined with another person. Maybe we need another person to help make us complete, but that's just me. I think it can be a very long and daunting process for someone to say, well, I'm going to study to become whole. I guess, first of all, we have to figure out what pieces are missing, don't we?
Yes, and when I say whole, I'm not talking about a complete person that has everything all together. Not at all. There is no such person. Not a single person. However, if we consider that we have thoughts and feelings and actions that can be integrated, then we are thinking of ourselves as whole.
I see. So, well, you say in your book that people must have their love acknowledged. I can't think of anything more important to humanity. How is this done?
Love is a big umbrella. Love is that resonance that happens between two people. And if you are really resonating to the core of who you are with another person, they are acknowledged and you are acknowledged at the same time. And it is through that kind of acknowledgement of who we are beyond just those thoughts, feelings, and actions that gives us the beginning point of that resonance.
Well, I know most people want to acknowledge what they're comfortable with. And if we meet somebody that's really dynamic, that really excites us, that really interests us or makes us laugh, I think most people just want to acknowledge the things they're used to. How do we acknowledge the things in the other person that they really need acknowledged?
Most of it has to do with how well we can tell the person what we want to have. We sort of depend upon the other person to intuit who we are instead of us knowing who we are. For instance, when I did my book, not this last book, but the second book, I was trying to find somebody who had the same creative process that I had, starting with the energy of creativity, but each person has a process that is their individual process. And I called several people that do book covers, mostly the book covers that I really liked and knew that they produced well. And I asked them what their creative process was. And three of the four people I called could not tell me their creative process. So I finally found someone that could and realized that that process was close enough to mine that we could work together. I acknowledged the creativity of that person. They acknowledged my creativity, but we did it through telling each other what our creative process was.
Ah, well, now you're talking about communication, and doesn't that involve more than just being a good speaker, right? There's more to it than that.
Well, hopefully, yes.
what's involved in listening? How do we really listen to one another?
You know, we listen to each other by expanding our space, expanding our pictures of how we see the world. If we can listen enough to hear the other person paint their picture of how at that moment in that particular subject they're seeing the world, then not only have we heard them, but we've expanded our space. We have grown.
Well, I understand that. Let me give you an example. Let's say I want to take the Prime Minister of Israel and the Iranian President to sit down, and I want them to communicate rather than throw rhetoric and threats at each other. How would they go about expanding their space to include the other person?
Well, probably they wouldn't.
you say they would not be soulmates, would they?
But we'll pretend like maybe there's a possibility. Okay, so we're saying there's a possibility. What you might do as the mediator of that would be to have each person to say what it was that they were trying to express. The other person would say what they were trying to express. And then you might be able to help to bridge those two pictures. Sometimes when people absolutely can't get together, it takes a third person to make a bridge. And I think in that case, it would take a third person to be a bridge.
What about the nonverbal communication? How do we get better at that?
That's so very important. It's so very important. Someone can come to you and have this perfectly polite conversation and just be radiating anger. And, you know, you sometimes can say, I'm feeling that you have a lot of anger. And they will acknowledge that, but sometimes they don't either. But, you know, they just won't say, yes, I'm angry, because they're not acknowledging it themselves.
I've heard it said that it's not so much what you say, it's how you say it that matters.
Yes, and it's the intent. The intent, not only the feeling behind it, but the intent you have behind the words. Are you intending to just express yourself? Are you intending to manipulate the other person? Are you intending to be right? Are you intending to share? The intent you have is very important. And sometimes people cover their false intent with really good words. And that gets confusing. But you do have to listen for the intent. And like I said, knowing yourself, when you know what your intent is, you begin to learn to hear the other person.
I think I know what that's like. My wife and I are halfway through raising 4 teenagers. Although 2 of them are now no longer teenagers, it doesn't mean that they don't sometimes act like them. But listening has been, I think, the key to getting through that and producing good young people. My wife used to say things like, how can you let your son talk to you that way? And I would say, what way? Because I'm putting on these special headphones that convert teenage speak into normal human speak. So I take out all the nonverbal communication and I listen to just the message the way that I think they really want to say it.
That's excellent. That's getting to the intent. That's very good. I wish my parents could do that.
Yeah, if I could sell headphones like that, I could make a lot of money.
You certainly could.
What's the, you talk about this in your book, what's the difference between spiritual perceivers and physical perceivers?
People, again, it's sort of the headphone thing. You have people that perceive the world through different eyes and different ears. There are those people who perceive the world through actions. And my husband is a physical perceiver, and he uses no nouns, only verbs. He talks about the doing part, and sometimes I have no idea what that subject is. It's just what he's going to do or what he has done. And I don't even know what that is. Then there are the perceivers of the feeling world, and those people, they perceive the world through feelings. They're the ones that sense when somebody's feeling angry or frustrated or very excited or intense. They sense those feelings more than they sense the words. And then there are the mental perceivers. These are the people that are able to paint bigger pictures with words and can many times perceive bigger pictures through words. But they're not always aware if there's a different intent, so they can get fooled by words. Then there are the spiritual perceivers. These are not necessarily the people that are spiritual in the sense of esoteric, but these are people who think in terms of using their higher centers, and they think in terms of possibilities. They think in terms of the biggest picture with all the little parts in it. And it really helps to know with your children, with your spouse, with your neighbor. It really helps to know how these people perceive the world, how their thinking mechanism works.
So we have to figure out how the person we're trying to have a relationship with perceives the world, whether they're a spiritual, mental, or physical perceiver.
That's right.
So how, if I was one of your students and you were teaching me to become adept at this, how would you instruct someone to classify that person as one of those three?
Well, it doesn't take too long listening to the person or watching them in your life to see. Just take one of your children. do they respond more quickly to an emotional request or to a mental command or to a physical offering?
That's a good question. Sometimes I think it's telepathic. If they don't want to do what it is I'm asking them to do, it doesn't matter whether I'm spiritual, mental, or physical.
Sorry, that is so true. I've raised two teenagers myself.
The idea, I think, as a parent, is to try to react in such a way that when they do what I want them to do, I express my pleasure and my confidence and my acceptance of that the best that I can. And I think what it does for the child, or I say child, the young adult, is that they desire to see me happy. Not that I'm ever unhappy, but they really want to please. And I think that's healthy. I don't think that.
Well, that's positive reinforcement. That's wonderful positive reinforcement, not necessarily good communication.
Well, I have
two granddaughters that live next door to me. One of them is a physical perceiver, and the other is very mental.
Wow, now, how does that go?
Well, with the very mental one, I need to give her details. I need to continually give her details about everything so she feels included. Give details to the physical, she could care less. I need to do with her. I need to do things with her for her to feel included.
You know, that's really a good point. I've worked with both of them
in their schooling, and they learn in very, very different ways. The physical has to have hands-on repetition of doing things, patterns. They think in patterns, whereas the mental, the very mental perceiver child, that child, you just pour facts and information to her, and she gets it.
Well, I know when I'm doing a honeydew, let's say, I'm outside changing the oil in the family car. It's not that my wife would actually crawl under the car and take the dirty oil filter from me, but if she just sat in a chair outside while I was doing it and talked with me, that would be great. And sometimes she does that because she knows it's great.
Well, that physical presence, perhaps you're a physical perceiver. And from what you've done in your life, you very well may be.
I know that I have moments in which I am. Well, let's talk about balance. You know, we need to balance these things, physical and mental and spiritual. Or do we seek out a partner that fills in the pieces that we lack? How does that go?
Well, we usually do seek balance. But again, I always emphasize that we need to not just depend on the other person to create that balance, but use them as a support in balancing themselves. My husband is very grounded, and I'm very psychic, etheric out there. And so he's very much a grounding tool for me. Just being with him grounds me. And I like that. But on the other hand, I help him to see the bigger picture, to go to a little bit broader perspective than he would go to, and he likes that. But I'm learning from him, and he's learning from me. While we're supporting each other, where we're weak, we're also learning from each other.
Sounds fulfilling. I have to apologize to my listeners. I forgot to announce our call-in number. It is 877-876-5227. 877-876-5227. I had some of you write from Europe and advised us to try to create a number where people in Europe could call in. And I realize that we don't have that right now, but we will. I don't know if it'll be toll-free, but you might be able to call it using one of the cable providers like Vonage or Skype, and you might come through pretty clearly. But we do invite your telephone calls. Jackie Woods is with us. We're talking about her book, Soulmate or Cellmate. And anybody that wants to call in, you can ask us anything, because there's a lot going on out there. And this is one of the more important things that we want to try to talk about here at X Squared Radio. We talk quite a bit about space on this program, not just outer space, but also inner space. When you teach about the various energies of the human spirit, how do you address the subject of flow of this energy and keeping it unblocked?
That's a very big subject that I talk about a lot. The energy flows up through us until we get to a clear space of claiming these spirit qualities. Then they flow back through us. So let's take it at the beginning. Let's say that something has happened in your physical world. You're going to have an emotional response to it. And that emotional response, if we stay attached to the happening with that response, then we don't get a whole lot farther than that. But if we have an emotional response that we allow to start painting the picture of what we're needing, why we're upset with that response, what is missing as an energy rather than as I would like for them to do this, or I want them to be that way, or I hate this pattern of their expression. If we can actually begin to detach that emotion from the person or the happening and say, this is just simply painting the picture for me. This feeling is painting the picture for me of what it is that I'm missing. Then we are beginning the upward reach for that quality or energy that we are not getting to experience in that moment.
Hmm.
Now, that's the first step. The second step would be to simply say, this is the picture that I have. This seems to be what is missing. And then as we claim that and say, I am that, open yourself to it and begin to say, what would it be like to experience this in my life? So you begin to open to the possibility that you are that energy, because we are. It's just we haven't claimed them all. And so you begin to open to that possibility, and as those possibilities come, you then take hold of one of them and define how you're going to bring that into your life.
And that sort of opens up, gets the flow happening.
That's right. So that flow of energy that began with your experience in the physical world moves all the way up through you and then comes back down. And instead of it being an upset this time, it is a celebration as it comes back down.
Well, how do we, let's suppose that flow is blocked somehow from something that occurred to us or some preconception that we built when we were very young. How do you clear that out of the way so that the flow can happen?
Well, for me personally, the way I work with people when I'm in session with them is that I go back to that instance that where we have a woundedness. I go back to that and we relive that. But a person can, if they will follow the feeling to the picture, then that picture usually has an image in it of that wounded part.
So how do you bring them to recognize that they were actually wounded long ago, and that this scar is what's keeping that energy from flowing in them?
Well, most people that come to me are aware that they're wounded and wanting help with it. The tough part is recognizing day to day that for us to be fully who we can be, and we haven't claimed all of that, that we still have wounds in the way. And the worst type of person is the one who's done a lot of work on themselves and believes they have no more wounds. It's very difficult.
Yeah, I think I know a couple people like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, listen, I just did a little bit of research just so you all will know. If you are in Europe and you want to call and you have, this is not toll-free, but you may have a way to make this telephone call where it doesn't cost you anything, you can call 530-876-3222. That's 530-876-3222 if you want to call in from outside North America and you don't have the ability to make a toll-free phone call to our 877 number, you can use that number. Just make sure if it is going to cost you something, go ahead and ask your question and hang up, because it's not going to be free if you call that number. Let me ask you this question. I know you said that there are people that they think they're finished. They're all healed. They have no more wounds. They're not going to be hurt anymore. Should we always be growing, or what happens when we stop growing?
We die.
Oh, we die?
Even if we don't leave our body, and that form of death, we really are dead. Because energy has to flow. It has to continually flow. And for that to happen, it has to go through this process of coming, going up and coming down.
Hmm.
And each circle, each cycle that it makes, we claim more of ourselves. And I know no one on this planet at this time that has claimed fully all that they can claim.
We used to say when I was attending seminary, you're either green and growing or ripe and rotten.
I like that.
So we try to always keep growing, even though you may be familiar with all these ancient manuscripts and prophetic writings and even scientific documents. You got to keep growing. Read it again. There's another level that you missed.
That's right.
Same thing with human relationships. I have been pleasantly married to my angel for almost 27 years, and we learn more about each other every single day, and it just keeps getting better and better, and we enjoy it.
It's like my brother said to me one time. He's very black and white. You know, he believes what he believes, and that will never change. And he said to me, "Doesn't it bother you, Jackie, that your sons don't believe like you?" No, because I'm not going to believe like me next month.
Well, you know, everyone can't be strong in everything. We have weaknesses.
Okay.
So how do we deal with our own weaknesses, or how do we deal with the weaknesses in others? I know there's two different subjects, but they kind of go together.
Yes. Well, let's start with ourselves.
All right.
It takes a courageous, honest person to admit that they have weakness, but it takes even more courage to heal the wounded part that creates the weakness.
Can we heal ourselves?
Courage because when you heal, you change. And unfortunately, the people around you don't necessarily want you to change.
I've never found that to be the problem. They all want me to change, at least when I was younger. So,
well, I'm sure they want us to change in the way they want us to change. But, you know, when I've had people that come that have, for instance, addictions to drugs or alcohol or something like that, and I tell them up front, you can't always count on, now, there are exceptions to this, but you can't always count on all your friends celebrating the fact that you're going to be changing. Because the way you are fits with the patterns of the other person, the way they are, and if you start changing, they have to start changing. So only do people celebrate you changing when they're changing also.
How long does it take to break a bad habit?
Well, that totally depends on the person. But if it is a bad habit, then there probably are layers of woundedness.
Well, let's assume it's not something addictive like smoking, where you actually have a physical addiction. Let's say it's using profanity. How would someone go about correcting that flaw in their life?
Well, first of all, you have to find out what you're trying to fill with the profanity, what part of you you're trying to fill, so that, again, the picture, the feeling, like I said, you're trying to find what is missing. You have to find the energy of you that is missing to fill the part that was filled with the profanity. Many times, if a person uses profanity a lot, it many times comes from the fact that they're really very angry.
That they're what?
Really very angry.
Ah, I see. Well, I know people that use profanity in describing engineering problems, that there's no anger involved. It's just such a part of their...
You said it's a problem. Now, people that use it that way as an expression, they don't consider it a problem.
I know, but to me, it's a personality flaw. So how can you help somebody, you know, work that out as a bad habit?
Yeah. Well, if they don't consider it a personality flaw, then it's not going to change.
Ah. So it is from within. You have to have a desire to overcome the weakness. First of all, you have to perceive that you have the weakness. A lot of people don't think they have a weakness, and someone will point it out in them, and they'll say, well, that's not a weakness. I don't have that weakness.
Right.
But until they recognize it themselves, I guess there's nothing they can do, is there?
No, there's not a thing that anybody can do until they want to change.
Mm. Well, what about childhood programming? I hear the biggest variety of excuses that one could imagine about childhood programming. Oh, I was that way when I was a kid. Oh, it's because of the way my parents treated me. What's the truth? How do we recognize that and get clear of it so we can release ourselves of that burden or handicap?
That's a big area. You know, a lot of people deny that anything happened in their childhood. Other people blame everything on their childhood. But
I've heard both.
both happened. But we all have to recognize that we certainly were impacted by our childhood. And I think it's a matter of looking at both. When we're in the wounded part, we sort of lose sight of how we were gifted. And some people just look at how they were gifted and don't want to look at the wounded. It's really looking at the whole picture, help the person to see that they're the whole picture, that they're wounded and they're gifting at the same time. If you can look at your childhood as both, then you can see that when you're going through your woundedness, you're still gifting people. And when you're gifting people, you're still bringing your woundedness. So, to me, how we perceive our childhood is how we're perceiving now. And how we perceive now is how we perceive our childhood. Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah, sort of. In some circles of teenagers, I'm perceived as a legendary parent. And they ask me, you know, how did you learn to be such a great dad? And I said, well, I had great teachers. You know, my mother and father were the absolute worst parents that one could ever imagine. And if they're listening, I don't think they are, both of them passed away, but if they're listening, I need them to know that. But in a good way, because they taught me exactly how not to be a parent.
Mm-hmm.
Everything they did, I did the exact opposite. And that is where my legendary parenting skills come from. So I don't know that I was wounded so much as that I was strengthened. Because that does not kill you makes you stronger.
Well, I was beaten as a child, and that created a great woundedness in me. But from that wounded part, I was also gifted, like you said, in that I was able to claim my strength through that and because of that to a great degree. And so if that's exactly what I'm talking about, is the giftedness and the woundedness being seen as the total picture.
Yep. I went through the same thing, and I vowed if I ever became a parent, I would never spank my children. And I after 27 years, have swatted one kid exactly 3 times. That's it.
That's pretty good.
In 27 years. And it seems to have worked rather well for all of them. I don't think I'm alone in the relationship journey, although the angel to which I have been married for the past 27 years has certainly made that period enjoyable. In the first quarter century of my mortal life, for me, I experienced manipulation on an epic scale. How can we avoid these kinds of relationships or help heal those who are in them?
That are in manipulative situations?
Yeah.
Well, manipulation is, it's rampant. It's rampant. Even when people don't realize they're manipulating, let me give an example. The other day, I had offered to help a friend move because I am pretty good at seeing the big picture, and she was just overwhelmed with all this furniture trying to fit into all these new spaces. And so I called her and I said, well, let's go over and look at the space and have some fun. Well, she had taken pictures of all of her furniture and all her belongings, and so we took those over to the new space. And I said, well, the first thing is not to be attached to any one thing being any one place or even in this house. And she said, oh, no, I'm not. Those were her words, but her feelings. She went through every picture and said, oh, I couldn't live without this. Oh, I love this. Isn't this beautiful? Oh, and this, I really like this. Now, she was moving to a different size space, so, you know, I had said, we're going to have to get rid of some things, so let's not have attachment. Well, her words were she had no attachment. Her feelings, on the other hand, were totally, completely attached to every single item. So I told her, I said, you know, I'm feeling a lot of attachment here. And she said, no, I don't have any. So I repeated back to her the words she had just said, and she said, oh, my, I am attached.
You know, two moves is equivalent to a house fire.
Oh, yes.
I just moved, I hope for the last time, no, I'm sure not, from North Carolina to Western Kentucky. And
Where were you in North Carolina?
I was in Vail, which is actually not far from where you are.
Uh-huh.
I built an estate there, actually a pretty nice place. Just a little bit out in the country where I could see the stars, and I thought that 6,000 square feet and a couple of acres next to a 95-acre game preserve would be paradise, and it was. But as I finished my second book and started doing some more exploration, I discovered that my life was going to go in a different direction, that the earth was going to go in a different direction, and that I actually wasn't retired after all. So I sold the estate and I moved into a place, literally the roof, the house, the carport, the garage, everything would fit in my old living room. And so we had two mother of all yard sales to downsize. And now we have fit just the bare essentials, including my studio, which is in the basement of this house, into this smaller house, and we'll see where we go from here.
Well, you certainly didn't have attachment.
No, I am not attached to anything on this earth. I have mm-hmm. transcended all of that. Maybe this microphone. I really like this microphone. And this computer screen. I like this computer screen. And this pen that I have in my hands. But other than that, not much. I think of, I kind of think of balance like two people in the same boat. Each has an oar. As long as both people are pulling equally, the boat moves forward. If not, then it just goes in circles going nowhere. How do we balance relationships between people so that one person isn't pulling all the time?
It's very important that we define... I say define to the lowest common denominator. I can't expect the person to be more than they are in any one area. Now, my husband has a wonderful sense of humor, and I have a good sense of humor. And he has play, and I have play. He has more play than I have. I tend to be a workaholic. He has more play than I have. So he has to he has to define to the lowest common denominator, which is me, around play. Humor, we're pretty much in balance. But to stay, for him to stay in balance, that means that he has to have other outlets for all of his play. Or he would get out of balance. So if we try to make a relationship be our total balance, unless we're very, very, very well matched, then usually we are going to feel a little out of balance.
Balance has
to be bigger than the relationship.
We have to have
definitions that work for both people, and that's why I say the lowest common denominator. I can't be more play than I am.
I know people just like that. A young couple, and really they haven't been married very long, but the female in the relationship gets virtually 100% of her psychological support from her husband. But her husband doesn't get 100% of his psychological support from her. He has other interests. Of course, he works, but he also plays sports, and he's active in art. He's a fantastic painter, a good musician. And involving himself in those other things takes him away from her and leaves her virtually unsupported. And I'm no counselor, but my friendship with them was pretty important. And I told her to pick up a hobby to balance his, so that she would have psychological support from other areas besides just him.
Yes, that was very good. And that's what we have to do.
Uh-huh.
It's very easy when we love someone dearly, as you do your wife and I do my husband. It's very, very easy to want to have all of our pieces together. But it's rare that ever works. Because
I know
we
rare.
Don't have balanced size pieces. My husband's piece of adventure, he loves to drive on the ice. No, I'm sorry. My adventure is just not. I think my piece of adventure is big. It's just not defined that way. So
he and I would get along pretty well. Every time it snows in North Carolina, we used to take the car out to the big parking lots and try to see how far we could go sideways.
Well, you should be fine.
It's sort of like NASCAR driving at 30 miles an hour. Yeah, but you have to have a rear-wheel drive car.
Uh-huh.
I think front-wheel drive was a conspiracy against those of us that enjoy driving in the ice.
Well, he would join you in that. But that's what we're talking about. We have to get to the place where we can say, all right, for the woman that can have 100% support from her husband, but it doesn't balance for him, then she's going to have to find out that balance. And those make for more soulmate relationships than those who try to just say, well, if I can't get it here, I'll just do without. That builds resentment.
And that's not healthy, is it?
No, it's not. And it builds a lot of dissatisfaction that over a period of time becomes unidentified. It's in there and just sort of rumbling around and comes out at things that aren't even important, because after a while it starts oozing out.
You know, I meet people all the time who have forgotten their dreams. They thought they had a talent at one time. Maybe they played an instrument in elementary school or something, but life just sort of got in the way. So what advice do you have for those who want to find those hidden energies and bloom into the flower they were born to be?
It helps to look back and see what were the energies that you expressed, say, while you were playing the flute in elementary school, or you were playing football in high school, or you were in charge of the newspaper, whatever it's called, or the yearbook, or whatever it was in your school. And not to try to recreate the same form. Unfortunately, people do think it's the form that was so satisfying. Instead, it was whatever energies that they could express through that form that created the satisfaction. So go back and say, what were the energies that I expressed in those forms? And you can find new forms. But those energies will still be there, still wanting to have that kind of satisfaction.
So it's not the form that's so important, it's the energy.
It's definitely the energy. I was big in sports when I was back in high school and college. And I had to look at what was it that I really enjoyed about that. What was that form? Because my body can't do those things for it anymore. So what was it that I really enjoyed about that? And what I really enjoyed was the team spirit, the camaraderie, the community energy is what I call it, the family energy, that kind of connection that you have in partnership. And so I looked at that, and I kind of looked at it in all those different areas. And for some people it might be just partnership, and others it might be more family. But for me it was really more community. I really am a community kind of person. And so I now live in an intentional community. And that satisfies that energy of community.
And what sport did you play?
I was a volleyball.
Really? Well, that takes a lot of jumping and falling down. It doesn't sound like fun.
A lot of jumping. Yes.
I played baseball. I could absolutely pound the threads out of a baseball. I could hit a baseball harder than anybody in my school. And I love the sport. And you talk about energy more than form. I think all of that is important. I like the cheer of the crowd. It was sort of like being a rock star when the ball went over the wall. It was that feeling was just intoxicating.
And so how have you duplicated that?
Well, now I'm over half a century old, and I do get frustrated that my body can't do the things that it used to do. Although I can still put one over the wall, I can't run around the bases like I used to. I have to chase my stomach. How do you relearn and unlearn patterns of behavior?
You do them at the same time.
Hmm.
As you give up one piece and you take it in small steps, as you give up one piece of a pattern of behavior that you don't want to have, and you break it down into steps. If you give up that step, you have to replace it with a new step. Because energy doesn't exist in a void, you know that. And so you have to have a replacement. But you can't do the whole thing at once because those patterns are too deeply ingrained into those different parts of you. It can be lodged more in your thinking memory or in your feeling memory or in your physical memory. But it's in there, and you have to replace it. And you have to replace it in the strongest memory first.
Hmm. And the strongest might not be the most recent.
May not be. It probably will be where this started. That will be the strongest. You go back to the time in your life when it started.
Well, I like the idea of time travel, but our perception of that event that happened in the past, or our behavior at that event in the past, isn't really necessarily the accurate one. It's maybe our perception of it.
Does it matter if it's really accurate or just our perception?
Oh, that's a great question. I should ask that question. Does it really matter? That's a good question. What's the answer?
Well, you might have different answers, but I feel that if it's our perception, it is our reality. And what is reality anyway? But our perception. I mean, it's all pretty much illusion anyway.
Well, what if if the way we perceive it and the way other people perceive it most assuredly will be different. How do we... Now, I guess there's three different perceptions. There's the objective reality about which who can report, I don't know. But there's the perception of others, and then there's our perception of that.
And what impact is our perception?
You're saying the only one that really matters is ours.
To us.
I see.
And it may be totally off from everybody else's perception of it. But that's what's going to impact us.
Yep, most assuredly it will be. Exactly right. I remember a story. I'm trying to remember the author, but I can't remember. It was just a small letter that was included in a literature book. And it was about a young kid, could have been a boy or a girl, who was... who had left a suicide note for the parents. And in it, the child had said that, pay attention to the one who's quiet in the corner, who, you know, isn't really involved in everything that's going on in the room because they have a lot to say, but no one will listen. And I guess it was a letter of despair, but it was included in this book nevertheless. And that person's perception was extremely important. But no one paid any attention to it until it was too late.
Right.
Well, my guest is Jackie Woods. Her book is Soulmate or Cellmate. I think it's extremely important that we build interpersonal relationships with one another and maybe leaders of countries as well. We will take about a 6-minute break here. And we'll be back with more of her comments. If you do want to call in, don't forget, the number is 877-876-5227 if you're calling toll-free, or if you want to call in, it's 530-876-3222, and we will be right back with more of X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio. Did you know that 11 of the 12 sets of footprints on the moon were made by Eagle Scouts? It's true. Soon, men and women will be doing the real moonwalk. But just so we don't forget, the first footprint on the moon has been replicated in a limited edition plaque that would make the perfect gift for a court of honor. Maybe you need something special for your office or your library at home. This high-quality plaque can add that something special that lets people know how excited you are. We are returning to the moon. Visit Countdown Creations at X Squared Radio today and order your limited edition First Step on the Moon plaque. Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They have come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio.
You know, dust is the place where the past meets the future. If you have done your genealogy and found that you have roots in the Irish or Scottish clans, then don't you think it would be a great idea to have a replica of your family crest? You can get a coat of arms, a ring, or even a family pardon that may help you or your grandchildren remember your ancestors. This is the time when the hearts of the children are turned to the hearts of the fathers. We only carry the best. So if you're ready to experience the glory of your past, you're ready to visit Scottish Heirlooms at X Squared Radio.
People are always looking for something inexpensive and unique to give people they love. Well, now there is a way to give a gift that not only says how long you will love them, but it also allows you to help keep the planet green and growing. Tree Givers at X Squared Radio is the company that will plant a tree on public land somewhere in the 50 states and provide your special person with a beautiful certificate of that place. This has become one of the most popular gift sites in the world. And because of their love for the Earth, they are changing the world. So visit Tree Givers at X Squared Radio and see if you can find a gift for your special person. Space shuttle fleet is very soon going to be retired. No other spacecraft in history has advanced the world more than this fleet. I wanted a way to keep that memory alive in my home, so I went to the space store and ordered a 25-inch model of the Space Orbiter. People who have seen it always comment on the incredible attention to detail in this model. If you know someone who loves this space program, and you want to get them a gift that they will never forget, you should visit the Space Store at X Squared Radio. Brooks Agnew here with X Squared Radio. If you like wildlife art and would love to add some of the most beautiful replicas to your home or office, you should visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio. They have everything from pandas to fish to eagles to horses in all sizes and price ranges. No matter what animal you love, they have the art for you. So visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio for that special someone today.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. This is where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive. By way of update, I wanted to let you know that not to forget, I know it's been 100 degrees outside lately, but don't forget about the summer of 2007 in June. I will be attending the North Pole Expedition. Recently talked to a couple members of the team, and they assure me that it will be a balmy at least 15 below zero about that time of year up there, and that the seas do settle down to about 120 feet swells. So I'm looking forward to it. Did want to let you know not to forget that there is a donation button in the online store at X Squared Radio. If you will go there, we appreciate any donations that you can make. Now, I need to let you know that the donations to this area are treated differently than any other purchase in the online store. If for any reason this expedition does not happen, and there may be a number of them, could be anything from the boat sinking before we get there to other things, all of those donations will be returned to their donator. I also wanted to let you know that if you donate, you are required to at least give us your name so that we can give you credit in the book that will be written in the fall of 2007. Now, that book is already over 200 pages long. We have written much of the introductory information to that expedition. And as we build the equipment and do our research, we will be adding to that book. But all of the contributors will go down in history, in print, in copyright, in the Library of Congress, as participants in that expedition, which could very well be one of the greatest expeditions ever done in modern times. So I want to let you know that that is there. Also, if you want to call in, it's our final hour, 877-876-5227, anywhere in North America. And if you want to call in from Europe, you can do so at 530-876-3222. Try to make it easy on yourself. Use one of the cable long-distance services, or make the call brief. We don't want to cost anybody any money. This program comes to everyone on Earth free of charge right now. We have well over 150 hours of information for you. Next month will be our one-year anniversary of X Squared Radio. I don't know if we have set any records or not, but according to Alexa, which is one of the website ranking companies out there, X Squared Radio is the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. We appreciate your listening. We appreciate your support. I love to get your emails, and we love to hear your phone calls. So please participate as much as you can, and I will do my part to continue to bring you the best content on Earth. My guest tonight is Jackie Woods. Her book is Soulmate or Cellmate. I recommend the book. I read it. Any of you that are out there trying to heal a relationship or start a permanent relationship, it is a great book. Jackie, I've heard it said that when you marry someone, you also marry their family. How do we get past this? How do we deal with the fact that when you marry someone, you marry their family? How true is this?
Well, you do. You are in relationship with their family also. However, I think it's incredibly important that we realize that we are bringing a relationship to the family now, and that's a new member for them. It's not just that our partner is a new person in the family, but our relationship is a new member in the family. And not to forget that. We tend to fall back into patterns of relating to family as we always did, and the partner gets left out. And while they may like the partner, and the partner may do very well with them, at the same time, we have a relationship that they need to be introduced to.
Well, how can we possibly find the perfect soulmate if we also have to find the perfect family?
Well, we don't have to find the perfect family, but we do need to really be clear with any family that this is our relationship. You are dealing with our relationship. You must honor our relationship. And the relationship has boundaries just as an individual does.
Ah, I see. And do the family, I guess the family introduces some of those boundaries.
The family will have their boundaries. But the relationship gets to have its own boundaries.
So one cannot expect to just pluck someone out of their family and move them halfway around the world and have their own relationship with them.
I think that the hardest thing for a person going back home is that they fall back into the same patterns they had when they were home.
Oh, I can see where this is going. Okay, keep going.
And when you bring your relationship partner with you, you have to stay in that relationship and not just fall back and be the child you were with your parents.
I see. So, and, you know, your spouse, who I guess you're going to go back to visit or maybe move back close to them. I just recently did that myself. you better be prepared for the extra pressures that your spouse's parents add to the relationship.
And the relationship, the two partners in the relationship need to support each other. They need to present it, a united front as a relationship.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've met people who, I hope this doesn't come out wrong, I have met people who seem to constantly pick the worst matches for themselves. I know women who can pick one loser after another. Even though they were raised in good and loving homes, they seek out the bad boys. I guess I was going to ask how to help them stop this, but perhaps they have some need for evil balance. How do you advise them?
Well, they have to see what they're getting out of that. If I have seen women that picked men that could never, ever hold a job, and the woman would have to support them. It would make the woman feel powerful in that she felt she was in charge. Or sometimes they pick somebody because they feel like if they are supporting them in being bad or weak or whatever, that it gives them an edge to being wrong. Now, you have to look at that. It's pretty sick, but you have to look and own that you're really doing that, that you're manipulating to get love in a way, or to feel better than, or to feel powerful. And that you have to own that that's not a very healthy way of claiming those images.
Well, it's not only unhealthy, at least from my observation on the outside, they're not happy.
No. Well, they're not happy, but to some degree, they have a need fulfilled. If a person, there are people, unfortunately, but there are people who feel so badly about themselves that they need to have an abusive spouse.
Huh. Well, how would you advise a woman who, let's just say hypothetically, they're done with their latest loser, they're in between relationships, and now it's time to pick someone to move forward with? How do you get them to break that habit? How do you get them to look at the church boy instead of the bouncer?
Mm, that'd be hard, because I probably choose the bouncer. No. What I would have them do would be to look and say, okay, when I'm with this person, when I'm with this bouncer person, what, there has to be some payoff. What is the payoff? And usually the payoff, if you really look at it, isn't as great as the loss. But you have to acknowledge and be honest with yourself about what that payoff is, and then you've got to change that pattern. That piece of the pattern has to be changed.
I think the payoff, at least from my observation on the outside, let me back up a little bit. Usually when I meet people like this, they are hungry for any kind of attention they can get. And usually, let's call it the church boy, he doesn't give that kind of attention on the first date. In fact, it takes a little while to get to know him. And the woman is not willing to make that kind of investment. She wants someone to notice now. And usually, that's the bouncer. So I see what they get out of it on the front end, but I don't see what they get out of it after a couple of weeks of this relationship. And yet, what I hear them saying, and if I'm a good communicator, I'm trying to listen with everything I've got, they're telling me they really want a personal relationship where they're treated with respect and they have an ability to grow. And like you say, they don't have to do all the work in the relationship. So how do we get them to do that?
You really need, when you've been in a bad relationship, you need to get out of a relationship totally. And you need to learn how to build respect for yourself, not outside of you in a relationship, but by yourself, through yourself. And you have to begin to find that you have worth and to realize that your worth is within you, not outside of you. Because if they're looking for that attention, they're looking for that worth, that acknowledgement outside of themselves, then they have to start building that inside in some way because they feel empty. And they'll settle for it in very bad forms and small measures. And if they have that self-worth beginning to build within them, they won't settle for that anymore. And it is amazing to me how some people can be very successful. I've worked with some women that have been extremely successful in business. Very intelligent women have made good money, have interacted with people in business very successfully, but they get into a relationship and they fall back into some of the relationship programming. And a lot of that depends on how well they were acknowledged and how much worth they felt in their family situation. And if they had a lot of worth in their family situation,
well, how do you get them
then
to
they usually don't get into
that.
Those bad relationships. But if they didn't, they may have learned to be successful in the world, but they will fall back into those patterns. Sort of like I said, when you go home to the family, you tend to fall back into how you were as a child. You know, going back to patterns of relationship that you've learned in the past.
How do you, as a teacher, train them to overcome that pattern?
I have them look at what it is the payoff. What is it that they're getting? What sense of worth do they have from that bad relationship? And let's start there. Only let's not build it in a relationship, let's start building it for ourselves.
One of the things that I notice when I see professional people, and I've got several friends that, they're very successful, and they've had a bad relationship in the past, and they've come to me and you know, said, "Hey, Brooks, you know, where should I go really to meet somebody? I mean, I don't want somebody to just like me for my money." And I gave them this advice. I have no idea if it was right or not. I told them, "Why don't you go to the local pet store instead of the local nightclub and build a relationship there first? And just live by yourself for a while. Get to know yourself, argue with yourself. Come at peace with yourself first, and then go looking for someone."
That's good, except you've got to be more specific about the patterns that you have in relationships, because sometimes you don't, as I said, you can be successful in business and live out of entirely different patterns, and even by yourself, than you do in relationships. So while you need to correct them while you're by yourself from the pet store, you need to know what those patterns are you have in relationships that you're correcting.
Well, I see where you're going. I mean, I can see that the longer you leave a dog, the more happy they are to see you when you get back. And that's not necessarily true with women. That might build a bad habit. Not really sure. That and the bowl of water on the floor. I'm not sure that goes really well either. But I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that some people have to have somebody around all the time. They as far as I know, they've never come to terms with their own space, with their own person. They have to fill it up with something.
That's very, very important. They do have to come to terms with their own space. They, as I said in the beginning, they have to know who they are to know what they have to bring to a relationship other than, well, I know how to caretake this person or I know how to give in to this person. They have to know what energies they bring, what qualities they bring, and then there can be a discussion with another person about what form that will take for both of them. But they can't have a discussion about forms if they don't have an energy.
Well, this kind of brings us back to perceptions, then. If the only perception of who you are and what your worth is what other people have given you, then you need to be by yourself for a while and gain some of your own perceptions about who you are, right?
Very good. You have to know who you are. You cannot be in a relationship if you do not know who you are.
Well, I guess that's why we have fine teachers and writers like you out there, so that we can know how to do these exercises, or even know that the exercises need to be done, so that we can find out who we are and what our qualities are, what dowry we bring to the table for a relationship with someone. I've got buddies of mine that I used to play ball with, and you know, you travel to different cities and you meet people and you're exposed to people, and inevitably one of them would turn to me and say, "See that woman over there? I would really like to get to know her. I like the way she smiles. I like her dress. I like the way she looks. I'd like to get to know her." I said, well, go up and talk to her. Go introduce yourself. And they said, "Oh, no. I couldn't possibly do that." I said, "Why? You know, bring yourself to the table. You know, I'm sure that they're here to meet people, too. And you're a ball player. They'd want to get to know you." Well, I guess you know what happened. They sent me over to get the name and to introduce and sort of break the ice and bring her over, and so that's kind of the reputation that I got. I would sort of break the ice and bring people. No, I never took the girl for myself either. But I you know, meet these guys who can run like the wind, hit with an iron fist. They've got great timing, great charisma, great coordination, but they don't know anything about themselves. They're not confident of themselves. They can't walk up to someone and say, "Here am I."
Probably because they are so skilled at ball, they have identified themselves as a ball player instead of, "I am a person who brings a lot of care. I'm a person who brings a lot of compassion. I'm a person who brings a lot of kindness or a lot of support." No, instead of seeing themselves as those qualities that they bring, those energies, those qualities that they bring, they see themselves as, "I'm a very ball player."
I think we have a caller on the line. Caller, can you give us your first name and where you're calling from?
Hi, Brooks. This is Al from New York.
Hi, Al.
How you doing tonight?
I'm doing good.
You have a very interesting show. I have a question to ask Jackie. Hello?
I was just asking a question. If you wanted me to come to New York to introduce you to someone, but I was being humorous. Go ahead, Al.
Okay. What does she think, or why does she think that there's so many failed marriages today? Is it because of the expectations of the couples going into marriage that soon after or 10 years after fail to come to fruition? That's my question.
I that's a very good question, and I believe that the answer to that is that when a relationship comes together, and it is good in the beginning, that relationships have to continue to grow just like people do, and we don't always have the tools to know how to keep them growing. And so the people keep moving and growing and changing. They move to this place, they have this job, they start having children, and their lives change, but the relationship patterns, they fall behind that, and they don't keep up with the change. Now, there's lots of reasons they fail. Some of them, like you said, we go in with expectations and we impose on the other person how we think they are when we haven't even gotten to know them, really. And then we'll get married and we find out after we're married that we're not even close to the person that we had imagined.
So we really have to give spend more time getting to know that individual, hoping that they'll be forthright and honest about their expectations.
Yes. And if you get to know a person well enough, you can tell a lot, not just by their words, but you can tell a lot by their actions. You can tell a lot by their responses to you. You can begin to know them beyond what they're just telling you.
Okay.
And as you as you get to know the person, then you really can fall in love. You know, what people do is they fall in lust, and then they try to turn it into love.
I see.
And it usually doesn't work too well.
Mm-hmm. Brooks?
Yeah.
Can I ask just one more question?
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay, thanks. How do you heal a relationship with your son-in-law if it's gone sour and because of some misunderstanding or, different things that have been verbally said, and now... one of the individual wants to, you know, come forward and talk about it, but the other individual doesn't, is obstinate. How do you deal with that situation?
It's difficult. It's very difficult when both people don't want to get together. I would recommend that you just go and put it out there and say, you know, I would really like to have a relationship with you. What would it take? Just ask them, what would that take? What would it look like to you, and what would it take?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Brooks, I appreciate you taking my call. And
thank you very much.
And Jackie, thank you for addressing my questions.
Thank you.
No problem, Al. Thanks for
calling.
Okay,
take care now.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's address that a little bit. You were talking about Al's question about the relationships not... coming to fruition. Some marriages end rather quickly, 1 year or 2 years, because, like you said, people fall in lust, and then they realize, hey, this isn't love after all. I think maybe there's two or three things that we could consider. Let's address the physical one first. We meet somebody, we're physically attracted to them, we think they're beautiful or they're handsome, and we want to get to know them. And let's just consider, let's assume that we know enough about ourselves to go up and offer ourselves to the person. Well, one of the things that I see in personal relationships is that people sacrifice too much in order to get into that relationship. They're really attracted to this person, and they don't want them to know that they've got this habit or that they've got this this political belief or whatever it is that would immediately disqualify them for a relationship with this person. And lo and behold, the relationship progresses for one reason or another, God only knows. And they end up falling in love and getting married, and then the whole person comes out. Surprise. If they really want this relationship to go forward and the physical isn't enough to carry them through this let's call it a honeymoon period, how do you recommend that they, if they really want to make the relationship work, what's the first step they have to do to make the relationship work from there?
Well, they have to start getting to know each other on the other level. They have to begin to see who that person is emotionally, how they respond, how they react, what they emotionally like and dislike. They have to know the person, not to please that person, but to know that person. And not to know that person to dislike the person or to like the person, just to get to know them. There's a difference in getting to know someone and then making a judgment call on how that person is, whether you like it or not like it. Get to know them and reserve judgment. Just get to know them. And then as you get to know that part of them, you add a piece. You get to know their political beliefs. You get to know their religious, spiritual beliefs. You get to know their social beliefs. You get to know that. And if we could, It's very difficult, but if we could just set aside the judgment and observe until we got all the way to those energies, those qualities of spirit that I talk about, to say, what is behind that? Maybe they believe very differently than you do about something, but they have a lot of passion behind it. A lot of the energy of passion. And you may love the passion even though you totally disagree with their belief. And while they may feel very emotionally strongly about saving the environment or saving animals or saving something, and that doesn't particularly strike you. However, when you follow it all the way up and you hear their words and you get to the energy of who they are behind that, when you can get to that, maybe that is their form of caring or compassion, and you can love their caring and compassion. You may be totally disagree with how they emotionally respond in the world with it, but you can love that part of it. So that you've worked your way from loving their smile and then finding you hate their emotional responses or you totally disagree with their belief system to finding out who they are and you can love that part.
I can respect that. I'm kind of reminded of the movie Fever Pitch with Drew Barrymore. During the summer months, she makes a relationship with the star of the movie, and then spring comes, and he's a Red Sox fan, and he's got season tickets, and she doesn't realize that the reason he keeps breaking their dates is because he's at baseball games, and she doesn't care about baseball at all. So that's how the movie progresses, and I thought it was pretty neat how they fall apart and then they heal that relationship when she sees how much baseball means to him.
Wow.
And what he's willing to give up his season tickets to be with her, then she realizes how important she really is. So then she goes to him and tells him not to give the season tickets up, which is great. You should see the movie. It's a good movie. Even if you don't like baseball, it's a good movie.
I love baseball, actually. I love baseball.
And you see odd couple relationships like that in public life, too, like Mary Madeline and her husband. You know, he's a Democratic strategist, and she's a Republican strategist. And you wonder how in the world they get along in their house.
And it could be the same energy that motivates them to do their different jobs.
Yeah.
That they really have in common. Not the jobs, but the energy.
You know, truth be known, they probably both laugh all the way to the bank.
Probably.
Well, let's talk a little bit about money. What about it? I hear people tell me their goal is to marry someone rich so they can have everything and travel without working. Do the wealthy have relationship problems like those from the people in more humble circumstances?
Do, and they have and sometimes different social levels have different programming and expectations about what a relationship should be. But it doesn't matter. If you have expectations, you have expectations. Some people are willing to cope with more in order, like some will cope with a lot to have great sex, some will cope with a lot to have great money. But coping is not the ideal soulmate relationship. And so, really, it's no different. Whatever strata you're on, there is no difference. You still have to approach a relationship in the same way, and that comes down to the basic, who is this person, and who am I, and what forms can we agree upon that fit both of us, and that will express who we are to.
Well, I see the lack of money to meet, say, just the basic needs destroy relationships. The arguments over money, over not having a new car, over not being able to buy the furniture that the woman wants, or not being able to buy the boat he wants.
Certainly can cause stress. There's no doubt about that. But having money can cause stress, too, because that can cause that the person to be that's making the money to be involved in their business just don't have enough money to make it, or they have to work all the time to barely make enough money to make it. So money can be a great stress factor. And I don't think there's a real easy answer for that. However, what I've talked about in the book is taking what you have and itemizing your priorities according to what you're going to spend your money for. And if you can itemize what you're going to spend it for in terms of who you two are in the relationship, and I usually say take three qualities that you both share and say, this is what makes up our relationship. And make sure you have, even if it's just a tiny bit, of money that you use to support that relationship, so that you're not just feeding your body and that you're not just keeping a roof over your head, but that you have some portion, very small it may be, or it could be large, but that you have some portion that supports the relationship itself.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely relate to that. There's nothing wrong with having cream of chicken soup and rice for dinner if both of you are happy with that and you're not stressing out because you can't go to the steakhouse to have dinner with your friends. The relationship will build, and I haven't been successful in my life. We've been through rough times. I've had businesses fail. And my wife and I have weathered that and I think become stronger for it. I have seen other couples go through the same thing we did, and it tore them apart. They didn't make it.
What would you say was your key?
Excuse me?
What was your key that made you make it?
I don't think there was a single key. It was that I guess I personally believe that we fall in and out of love many, many times in a relationship. And what happens is the times between when we're in love get shorter and shorter and shorter as time goes on until it just becomes love all the time, no matter what you're in. And neither one of us ever had the tendency of saying, well, see, that business failed because you did this or you didn't do that. It was just something that didn't work out, and we stayed with it. We stuck with it. Yeah, it was hard. And coming through it and building back and getting another house and growing from there, building another business, that was good. That was a great feeling, and overcoming it, I think, was the key, instead of giving in to it.
And so your subject really wasn't money, though. Your subject was more changing and growing the relationship as the circumstances changed.
Yeah, and that and the fact that both of us came from dirt. You know, we came from poor families. So when it got down to the point where, you know, we only had a few $100 a month to make and four kids to feed, we were used to it. It was what we had come from. So it wasn't devastating to us. We didn't come from wealth, either one of us. I know this sounds very, very strange and foreign to people who might be listening, but, you know, my wife's family didn't have an indoor bathroom until she was 16 years old. That's just her reality, and my reality was different than that. But, you know, I came from individual poverty. I left home at a very young age and worked to get everything that I have, and so I was kind of used to it. It wasn't one of those stresses that would tear us apart. In fact, if people really want to know, the one thing that results in more divorces than anything else, beyond alcohol, beyond infidelity, is winning the lottery.
Wow.
Winning the lottery results in more divorces per capita, I'm talking lottery winners, than anything else.
That's very interesting.
Because it's such a radical change.
But then we do have to come to agreement on how we spend our money, whether it's a little bit or a lot. We have to have an agreement. And we have to have an agreement that if the money be spent whether we divide it up, you get this much for yourself and I get this much for myself. But we always have to have something that we keep for the relationship.
Yeah.
You know, when money gets really tight, you say, well, for instance, when I was raising my son, I'm remarried now, but I raised him by myself, and money was really tight. And I didn't have a lot of money to take them to movies and things like that, but we had a park that was very close, and I made a big to-do over a picnic, and I made a big to-do over carving a pumpkin, and I made a big to-do over making our own Christmas tree ornaments. And so what money I spent and what time and energy I put into a relationship still equaled the same value that somebody who put a lot of money into. So that we don't just go by dollar value.
Yeah, we always looked for the free stuff too. The local park used to have a free movie on Friday nights. They would spread out a couple of bed sheets and take out the 70 or the 35 millimeter. I think it's maybe, I forget what it was, the movie camera, the movie projector they had at school. And they'd show things like Superman and, you know, some of the older movies. And we'd go out and sit on blankets and watch the movie for free and have fried chicken and, you know, water, whatever it was we could muster at the house. We'd take the kids out and sort of go to a sit-in movie, and that was free, and it was pretty cool.
And, so you were putting some money into the relationship, even
yeah.
if it was just the fried chicken. In other words, you included the relationship in the definition of your finances.
Yep.
And you have to do that, whether it's a lot of money or a little bit of money, it has to be proportioned so that the relationship has its share. But that it only has a share. Some people just pour all their money into their relationship and their bills don't get paid. It has to have a share.
Yeah. Well, my children have never been on a cruise because we just couldn't justify dumping $4,000 or $5,000 into a 3 or 4 day boat cruise. So the kids would have a memory, and our bills wouldn't get paid.
So that's what I'm talking about. It has to be in proportion to the needs.
Right. Well, that doesn't mean that we won't someday all go on a cruise together, but Dad probably will not be able to take that parachute jump like we wanted to when I was younger. Although I'm still probably young enough to do that, and I do fly ultralights. Because I like the feeling of sitting in a lawn chair at 300 feet. And I like the feel of the wind in my face as opposed to sitting in a cockpit driving a car at 5,000 feet. And generally things that are loud and dangerous I like. And I haven't outgrown.
Like expeditions.
And everyone in my family has been up in the ultralight, so they enjoy it, except for my wife. She suffers from motion sickness, but that's okay. There's no window to roll down, so she has, yes, fed the fish from 450 feet several times. I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. It's like we've known each other our whole lives. And I guess it's just by nature of living in North Carolina, people are like that. I guess one of the things I enjoyed most about living in North Carolina was the stars at night.
Yes, they're
beautiful. You just don't see them on the eastern seaboard like you see them in North Carolina.
They're beautiful.
Something about the way the jet stream turns at I-40 and goes back north or something. I enjoy it. So how long have you been in practice? And tell us a little bit about your clinic.
I have been in practice 25 years, and I've been in North Carolina for 8 of those years.
Tell us a little bit about your clinic there.
I was in Atlanta before. I came here and built a healing center building first, and had several practitioners, have a chiropractor and a massage therapist. therapist and a nutritionist and an herbalist and a color and sound therapist. And then I do my classes and my work there. And we grew, and we continue to grow, and then we built the Institute building where we're a CEU continuing ed provider for music therapists, for counselors and massage therapists, and social workers. We do online courses for their continuing education. And we did bigger workshops, and we added in that 8,000 square foot building, we have a colon hydrotherapist, and we have yoga classes and Tai Chi classes and non-violent karate classes, and we have cooking classes. We have added another chiropractor. We have added another massage therapist. We have a woman who works with children who does music imagery with children. Goodness, what else do we have? We have a circuit training room there. We have a health food store there.
It sounds like quite a complex.
It's pretty big, and I teach classes on site and online. I teach growth classes online too.
And what is your website?
It's jackiewoods.org. JACKIEWOODS.org. jackiewoods.org.
And how can our listeners get your book?
They can get it on the website or through any bookstore. We have a national distributor. So if they don't have it in stock, just ask for it.
Great. Awesome. Well, I've enjoyed myself. Have
I
you?
I have enjoyed it. You're wonderful. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate that. And I appreciate the contact with your publicist. She's a nice person and has done very well in representing you. And we look forward to working with you and her again.
Thank you. Thank you.
Been my pleasure. Bye-bye. All right, Earth Explorers, we have about 4 minutes. I did want to bring you up to date on some things. Don't forget, next Sunday, after the conference at Trout Lake outside of Seattle, Washington, we will be broadcasting live. And I'm going to do my best to try to get set up outside, or at least as close to outside as I can get, if we can get the bandwidth. My producer is going to be there. I finally get to meet him in person. And James Gilliland is going to be there, and Dr. Nick Begich is going to be there. I don't know if I can get them to come on the air, but it wouldn't take much. I'm sure maybe a moon pie and an RC will get them to come on the air with you. Don't miss that. And we're going to have a great month in September, too. I haven't yet released it to the website, but you're definitely going to like it. Also want you to pay close attention to the news. If you come across anything that I should know about or that our listeners should know about, feel free to email it. Of course, you can always go to x2-radio.com, which is X Squared Radio's website, or you can contact us through the BBS Radio Network by going to bbsradio.com. X Squared Radio has a page there which does post a bio on each one of our guests. Links to their books and links to their CDs or DVDs if they have any. So you need to visit that. And if you have the call letters of your local AM radio station, make sure to send those to us so we can get them to connect to Global Star Radio Network, which is our satellite uplink. And we may have more of those coming very soon if our good friends out in Paradise, California are working hard to do that. I do want to thank you for being with us tonight, and I will play my exit. I appreciate every single one of you. It has been our pleasure to have you here this evening. Tell a friend about us. Because every Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we try to provide the best 3 hours of talk radio on Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours where you live, send the call letters of your local radio station, and we'll do the rest.
Remember, Earth explorers, who you are. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Be aware that every life is immensely valuable. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorer.